I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody, and welcome to Talk to the Audience, where this is always death. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey. Happy to be done with this lousy smart weather. Who is here with me today, as always?
Owner of Billabong Sportswear now, Henry Gilbert.
Hey. Far out, man. I have not seen a Billabong in years, and I'm going to give up that joke right up at the front. And yes, this is our community podcast, if you're not aware. At the end of every month on Patreon, the beginning of every month on the free feed, we go over what's happening in the world of The Simpsons and in our world, and then we respond to questions and comments that you left on our Patreon for the most recent round of episodes. And yes, we are now sliding into April. Things seem to be improving if you're not in the Ukraine, but
yes,
in America, sure.
Yeah, man.
Hey, those numbers are dropping.
numbers are dropping. Things are opening up. You can just walk into a store without a mask on in California, which is weird. Like, I still feel like, you know what, I'm going to keep my mask on for now anyway, even though I'm fully vaxxed and all that. I'll get the fourth shot if they tell me to.
Oh, you're going
to
be paying out the nose for that one, buddy.
Yes,
We're simply out of money.
The White House, they just ain't got no money no
more. You're going to be billed for the last three.
Retroactively, because they're like, look, guys, you've had it too easy with all of this.
You didn't die, did you? Well, then pay up, buddy. Nina is not here this month, unfortunately, but she's here in spirit.
Yes, yeah. We should just have, you know what, from now on, let's send her all of our comments, and she can just, like, record them and send them to us, and we'll play them.
That'll make my job easier.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. But it was really fun having Nina just to hang around with as well.
Having a guest in the studio after 2 years?
Yes, also that.
That was fun.
Yeah, and this, I guess, is recorded. Look, if something happens between Friday and Tuesday before this post, don't blame us.
Owe you a Coke.
Yes, yeah. Hey, I've been really hoping, you know, Clarence Thomas has been in the news lately, and we mentioned him on the newest Talking Simpsons, and I was really hoping for once that curse would work out.
I'm sick of the curse because people are applying it too broadly. Now, listen, it's got to happen to somebody who was a voice on the show, not somebody who is depicted on a show 3 weeks ago.
Yes. Yeah.
In that case, anybody who dies is part of the death curse.
Yeah, exactly. Just because they have a joke about Madeleine Albright when she's voiced by Tress McNeil, it does not count as a Simpsons curse. Guys.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So I'm fine if it's like a Gordie Howe or let's say a George H.W. Bush figure.
Yeah.
In that case, yes, but you have to apply it correctly. Mm-hmm. Don't make me tap the sign, the death curse sign. But yes, let's go over Simpsons news. Lots of new episodes lately, including an episode of Homer and Marge Trapped Nude. It's called Pixelated and Afraid. Is that a parody of Naked and Afraid?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I watched all four of the new ones this month, and they were good. Like, I think the show I've been hearing on Twitter some of the discourse going, like, this is the best season of Simpsons in a while. And I do think it's been, the four I watched this month were really good. Like the Homer and Marge one was really a trip to watch because we're right now in the era of Homer is a hateful monster who doesn't like his wife at all and is the worst husband ever. And meanwhile, that new episode was about that Homer and Marge love each other, but they have become a boring, you know, couch couple who doesn't go on adventures or do anything romantic. But the central conceit is that Homer loves her and does not spend every day at Moe's, which is very different
than alarming.
Season 13 Homer, yes.
And I see this one, by the way, I've been very, very busy this month, have not seen these. I'm planning for finally celebrating my nuptials with other people in public after a 2-year delay, so I'll be taking a trip much later in April, but I'm doing a lot of planning ahead, so very busy. But the next episode we're going to talk about is the wilderness excursion one with Bart, Martin, and the Bullies. And I like that it's called Boys in the Highlands because 30 years ago, we had Boy Scouts in the Hood.
That's right.
So we're running out of title parodies, folks.
You know, it's not a title parody if you don't do it at least twice in the entire series.
Yeah, like the Old Man and the Sea Student, the Old Man and the Lisa.
Yeah, and the Old Man and the Key.
There you go.
Also that, yeah.
We need one more. I bet there was one more.
That one was interesting because, one, it was Nelson and Dolph. No Jimbo or Kearney with Dolph, so it was Dolph by himself. And also, like, it was the first Martin-centric episode since Gray Griffin. I believe that's sometimes she's still credited as Gray Delisle. It's hard to keep track of. But Gray Griffin did Martin the whole episode. And I really am getting to like her Martin voice. I think she does a good job. There's no replacing the very specific high-pitched voice of Russi Taylor. But I think she did good. And yeah, it actually made Martin like an interesting character. Him and Bart's dynamic was interesting to hear too. And the Marge Homer episode was funny too, I wanted to say, because it was about how a couple that watches reality shows together all the time, and then they actually get stuck in the wilderness, not unlike the Simpsons, the camping episode in season one. Hmm. And they're naked as well, but they use all of the tricks they learned on reality TV to save their lives.
And there was no reality TV when Call of the Simpsons was out in 90. Sorry,
yes,
90.
Yeah. But yeah, that the Martin episode was good and good looking too. Yeah.
And there's an episode that aired recently, episode number 720. It's got a long name. Let me say it. It's called You Won't Believe What This Episode Is About. Act 3 Will Shock You. And it was completely helmed by all women. The first time for the entire series. I mean, The Simpsons had a history of being bad at, you know, hiring women. The first woman was hired in season 6, Jennifer Crittenden. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's not a lot of women after her. There's a lot more now, but it took a long time for them to hire a more diverse writing crew. But yeah, directed by Jennifer Moeller. And I looked up her credits. She started on Futurama in season 2 and then moved to The Simpsons after Fox canceled Futurama. So
wow.
She's been with The Simpsons since 2004.
And it's finally direct. Well, I'm not sure if this is her first directing one, but yeah. And like,
she's been directing since like 2018 or something that. Yeah.
So this is her first one partnered with a woman in Christine Angle. And then on top of that, assistant director, the lead timer and background layout, all women as well. Like a real first for the series in the 720th episode. I even saw, this is in public so I can say, it was on LinkedIn. I saw Susie Dieter like congratulate one of the women who posted about it on LinkedIn. And Susie Dieter was like, wow, you know, I was the only woman in the group of animators back then. So it's amazing to see how far it's come since
then. The first and only for a while.
Yeah.
But yes, the episode, I didn't watch this episode. Again, my apologies. But the title bothered me because I'm like, did a 60-year-old write this title? Because this is what clickbait was in 2011.
I mean, I think it is one of the Gene-helmed ones. Mm. This is going to sound, it was a good episode, though not my favorite of the four this month, but yes, it is about Homer gets canceled and has to deal with it. And he goes viral because even though he actually, get this, Homer actually isn't cruel in this episode, as cruel as he would be in any season 12 episode, he is actually going to buy Santa's Little Helper dog ice cream. And Santa's Little Helper locks, and he leaves the windows open and the AC on, and Santa's Little Helper locks himself in and rolls up the windows, and everybody thinks Homer did that to his dog, and everyone in town hates him.
That's why you need to leave the note on the windshield that says he's inside listening to his favorite music, the AC is on.
Homer didn't know, and then he tries to make an apology, and then he actually says, sorry, you were offended, and then he is super canceled and can't go out anywhere. And then there is a big third act crazy twist that involves Kumail Nanjiani's character trying to help Homer. And also several other characters have been canceled as well. They become basically a Suicide Squad parody.
Mm.
Act 3 gets crazy. The best one was that Helen Lovejoy was a lemonade Karen who was like calling the cops on a lemonade stand. I thought that was good.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the last new episode that was just last weekend was Bart befriends a cool kid who gets him into like basically this thing called Slipreme, which is a parody of, I believe, Supreme fashion.
So this is, ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
Yes. Yeah.
As Liam Neeson says every Friday.
I can't feel my face when I'm with you. And the fact that I know that and sang it poorly just now was makes me just like Homer in that episode, who as a man in his late 30s, early 40s, he is trying to be hip. But by being hip, he is ruining Bart's new friend's cool stuff. So, and yeah, it's just about Bart befriending a kid who's like, I think it could be Bart's first black friend also in the entire
series. What about
series.
Lewis?
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, he's off to the side. Okay, you're right.
He's always been there. He had as many lines as Milhouse once.
I think Lewis actually has a line in that episode even, I think. Mm. But and as always, when Homer or Bart get like fancier clothes, to see the heavily stylized fashion designs on the incredibly simple, like oh, Bart got a crazy new sneaker. It looks weird on the regular clothes they normally wear.
I'm actually looking at all of the recent episodes, and I'm seeing some recastings, some race-based recastings. So Don Lewis, who plays La Barbara on Futurama, is Bernice Hibbert now.
Oh, that's right, yes. Yeah.
Jay Farrow is Dredrick Tatum, and Kimberly Brooks is Lewis.
Right, wow, okay, yeah. Yes, that's true. I didn't, in the viral episode, that's when Bernice and Dredrick Tatum have lines. It's the first time they've had lines since this new season. So, wow, I didn't care. That's good. Mm-hmm. Okay. Man.
It's going even to the very lesser characters in the show.
Why? Well, I would wonder if every time they write their scripts, they just keep going to like, oh, wait a minute. This guy was also a white guy. Crap. All right. Let's find somebody else. Let's take another part away from Tress MacNeille or Hank Azaria.
Disney can pay for it.
Yeah. I hope they're not having to cut budget elsewhere for this, and that Disney is just going like, here's your diversity money. Like, let's, since you're going to get nice headlines from these recastings, let's at least give you the money to pay for it.
And up front, we mentioned Ukraine, and yes. There's Simpsons related news in that the show took a stance and it's anti-Putin.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, look, hey, we also, just to be clear, listeners, in case you need us to say it, we don't think Putin should invade a country either. That's bad. In fact,
all illegal invasions are bad, especially the ones that we did.
Yeah, yeah.
Henry and I, that's what I'm talking about.
And you know what? We wish we could have stopped America from doing it, same as Putin, but we couldn't. But yes, yeah, so a lot of people are doing Stand with Ukraine stuff and, you know, putting the Ukraine flag or colors in their Twitter handle or whatever. And of course, conveniently for The Simpsons, yellow and blue are the colors. And so Silverman himself drew the solidarity picture, and Marge and her face and hair are right next to the flag. And so they kind of run into the other. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a nice statement. And I also wanted to mention it just because we don't do this every time, but I really was sick of seeing this. The show did not predict this. This is nothing like what happens in Simpson Tide. Okay, guys?
Yeah.
It's not.
It's not cute anymore, especially because people are dying.
Yes, yeah. Please don't bring that up.
We were talking about this sketch in the Discord for a while when it was released, like late February. Mm. And we were like, it's just, there's something off about it. It seems unfinished. And our hypothesis was, David Silverman had a concept. He sent it to the producers. They're like, yeah, it's great. We're going to put it online. He's like, no, no, no. I want to finish it. So it looks like a mix of like established character art and his own like sketches of things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it seems like there was a miscommunication there, or they make him do everything and he didn't have time to do one more thing.
Yeah.
Let the man rest. I saw Al Jean tweeting on David Silverman's birthday. It's like, it's David's birthday and he's working on the new short. Let him rest.
Yeah.
He's 65 years old.
I mean, maybe he wants to do it. Maybe he wants it.
Hey,
I don't know.
That new Obi-Wan show needs promotion, and they've got to do it.
I mean, again, I've said it a million times. Silverman, the best artist, the most important artist The Simpsons ever had. If you want him to win an Oscar, give him the fucking time. Give him a budget and time. Don't rush him on all this shit. It drives me crazy. But speaking of Silverman, there was another bit of news I pulled in late, but it was just yesterday when we recorded this.
That's right. He pulled in some of the earliest Simpsons animated drawings from the short Goodnight Simpsons, and that work began on March 23rd, 1987, making the show 35 now. I believe it started in mid-April of 87, though?
Yes, okay. Yeah. The MGO one aired in mid-April. Actually, let me just pull up the tweet here. Yeah, so it aired April 19th, man, wouldn't it be awesome if it was 420? But so if you're counting broadcast as the birth of The Simpsons, then April 19th is when it turns 35. But Silverman shared on the 23rd that it was that day in 1987 that him, Wes Archer, and Bill Kopp, with Matt Groening, started to work on Goodnight Simpsons and drawing it. So, and I would guess Groening had done the, you know, storyboards before that, so it's even like, you know, when is The Simpsons born, you know? But it was really something.
In that meeting with Gracie Films when he quickly doodled them so they couldn't steal his rabbit characters.
But yeah, if you want to go to Tubatron's Twitter, and you can see some of his very first sketches of Maggie falling out of the tree in her crib. And that's why, you know, Silverman loves Maggie. I believe it's the first Simpson he ever drew.
Dad, what is the mind?
What's mine? No matter. What's matter? Never mind.
That's what he does in the short.
Dad?
Yeah?
What is the mind?
What is mind? No matter. What is matter? Never mind.
I love his laugh is a funny laugh. I love that drawing.
That's not the laugh that Homer would have later. So you added this rudely while I was on my walk over here.
Sorry.
Daniel Radcliffe learned about America from The Simpsons. What's going on there?
Oh, yeah. It's just so Daniel Radcliffe, he's promoting something. But it was an interesting interview he just did on the Kelly Clarkson show about how I always wonder this about regular British people. And he certainly is he was at one time a normal British person. I was like, oh, what did they... Is Simpsons their window into America, and what do they know? And so he had a funny story about facts he learned from The Simpsons growing up. I wanted to just play real quick.
So wait, speaking of like American treasures, is it true that The Simpsons was like kind of how you learned about America?
Yeah, I feel like for a lot of people growing up in England, like there are things I know about America and American culture, like. Like, by the time I was 8 years old, I was like, Bismarck is the capital of North Dakota, and I know that because of The Simpsons. And I feel like there's a ton of just, like, movie stuff and references to things that I did not understand when I was watching the show, and then I saw those movies, like, 10 years later, and I was like, oh, A Clockwork Orange, or, like, Indiana Jones. Like, oh, that was what that was. And, yeah, that was, I think, a big introduction to, like, all
it's
of
not
America.
Far off, you know, it's, the show.
I think it's not a, far off. I mean, it's, like, I think it's a, if you wanted to, like, just, if you came to Earth tomorrow and had to quickly educate somebody about the last 30 years of American culture, you could do worse than doing The Simpsons.
I'm just saying.
And he's a frequent guest star.
Yes, multiple time guest star. But yeah, I just that was just also like, hey, stars, they're just like us. Daniel Radcliffe is basically our age and learned slightly younger, but
much younger.
You know, yeah, I guess we had graduated college when that first Harry Potter movie came out.
I started college. Your calendar's all over the map,
wait,
Henry.
Yes, I never graduated college. Look, my point
you're
is
still in some college. Mark that off on your resume.
But yeah, I thought that was a funny when I was doing some last minute Simpsons news stuff. I also saw, well, last minute thing was like Harry Shearer did an interview for a Maine newspaper, and it was just him saying like, yes, I do still do The Simpsons.
It's the one begrudgingly delivered line about The Simpsons that's in every Harry Shearer interview.
He did say somebody asked him, did you do Al Jean told me they could do it 10 more years of it, do you think you're ready for that? And he's like, hey, I'm young, and he's like, I'm still fresh, I can still do it another 10 years.
Every Harry Shearer statement is like, the checks still show up, so I'm still there. So
yeah.
That's his attitude towards the show. And yeah, Latin America is totally stealing Universal Studios lunch here, because there are so many cool bootleg Simpsons bars happening. And Eater did a good article about this. And I was astounded to know that in like Ecuador and Guatemala, there's a ton of Moe's bars you can go to.
Yeah, it was so cool. The research done in it is so impressive. And it is like, you know, we were just talking about Tamlin McGee is the writer that, you know, here we're talking about a British person's view on it, but we don't think enough about like what happens, you know, south of America's border, what their fandom is of The Simpsons and what The Simpsons mean to them. And yeah, I mean, this story links to like ones in Mexico, ones in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Colombia, Brazil, like just there, all over the place.
There's not one in You Are Gay. So.
You know, I wonder what they thought of that joke. The every person in Uruguay.
It's the only time they reference popular culture.
But man, yeah, and all the counterfeit Duffs behind the big Mo. Actually, the Mo, they taped in the one of the pictures, they taped a phone to Mo's standy hand. That's so funny.
And again, I've said this complaint before, but the Moser Universal don't like it. I don't like that it's bright in there. I don't like seeing strollers and children in there. Mm-hmm. I don't like that you're served like Sam Adams in a plastic plastic cup. I've said this before, and I'll keep saying it. I want the Star Wars Disneyland Cantina experience. You brought in for two drinks, you're taken out, but you get the entire Moe aesthetic all around you.
You know, I think I figured out an extra facet of why the Flaming Moe there isn't good. And it's not just because I think they want to sell it to children, but also because I think they have a liquor license that extends to beer, but they do not have one for spirits. And you would need spirits to make the proper Flaming Moe. I think, though.
Or cough syrup.
Or cough syrup. Yeah, I guess that would probably be illegal. But I just want it to be purple. Can it simply be purple?
I don't know. There's a way to add rum to your Harry Potter butterscotch beer.
Oh, that's true.
But it was so complicated that I didn't end up doing it. What for a shot of rum in this rapidly thawing drink? No.
Yeah.
I don't remember like how you do it, but I guess there are spirits on the premises.
Yeah, I think that's right. I had to like leave. I remember they said like, okay, here it is. If you want rum in this, go over there and they'll give you rum. They can't mix it for you. So I think I think legally there, it also is like, we can't mix a drink for you, but we can give you straight rum and you put it wherever you feel like putting it, buddy.
That's like when I went to Starbucks recently, and I understand why, but they won't fill travel mugs there. So I got a cup of coffee, dumped it in my mug and threw it out in the store. It's like, well, there's just waste.
Just doing eye contact with them the entire time.
They don't trust teenagers to handle travel mugs.
Yeah, I get it. You know,
but my local coffee shops will.
Mm-hmm. Hey, that's why you know, stick with local. You don't got to do Starbucks. Yeah.
And mentioned it up front though, Billabong is doing some Simpsons crossover clothes. Henry bought the Moo Moo shorts, I believe. Did I see you with a new hoodie as well?
I did. Also talked about last time the Levi's Wig Sphere hoodie. I also purchased.
Oh, that was a Levi's hoodie. Okay.
Yes, but yeah, there's I got it right here. My Moo Moo shorts for my summer look. Living, gonna be swimming in these. I think I've now lost enough weight that I don't feel that it doesn't feel like a joke to wear Homer's fat guy clothes.
No one's gonna say I got a movie for you, a fridge too far,
as I just stand there and not react to that ADR line afterwards.
Exactly, but, just like in the show.
But yeah, you know, and that Levi's one, it is a quality hoodie. That should not be as much as it was. It was $90.
Yikes.
But I mean, hey, it's a good, it's the first one of those. It's made better than the like $50 screenshot hoodies that Hot Topic makes. And it also has the Matt Groening signature underneath it, which is seemingly not on any of the Hot Topic ones. Hmm. But yeah, is it $96 good? Well, I don't know about that. But the Billabong shorts also weren't cheap. But hey, I think they're nice. There's also a donut one, but I think I preferred Homer's floral muumuu was a better coloring.
It's a classic design.
Yeah.
And in more Simpsons merch news, Igloo Coolers have some new designs, including the Quickie Marts, the Simpsons dancing, and some really weird season one designs.
Yes, yeah.
That one with Homer with his fingers in the air, it's like it's the key art they use for the arcade game when you win a level.
Like,
oh, I guess Homer dances like that.
It's the exact one. But I like, honestly, I'm glad they picked season one key art to make it look like a thing that would have been made in 1990. I kind of like that.
No, I do like it. And you can get the classic SDTV look, the purple TV, and of course Duff beer.
Yeah, and one that's like you just bought it from the Quickie Mart. I love the Duff cooler, that it's like an in-universe cooler with Duff on it. So, you know, it looks like Disney is saying yes to a lot of companies now.
I remember when the first real line of shoes came out, was that in like 2020, summer 2020?
Yeah,
that was opening the floodgates. Now there's new stuff all the time, I feel.
Yeah, it feels like they are working with like three different shirt companies and four different shoe companies all year long. Yeah, it's crazy.
And we have more news here about Simpsons vet Rich Moore leaving Sony. He was there very briefly. He left Disney to go to Sony. Now he's going to be working at Skydance, which we know is where John Lasseter fled.
Yes, yeah. You know, I have to, if I could have just said this, to be like, oh, it's Skydance. Who knows what that is? But if you're in the animation, if you pay attention to animation at all, yes, you know that Skydance is where John Lasseter went to be in charge. And it does seem like it actually is, you know, the company is spending money on big name talent. And I do look forward to like, oh, what will Rich Moore or Brad Bird, who's also there, do? But it just is like, I know every company is run by an asshole, but why has it got to be John Lasseter there?
Yeah,
you know? Like,
especially
why?
A guy who contributed to a terrible company culture that they seem to be just recovering from. It feels like Turning Red is the first movie in production since he left, which is why it's a different vibe than a lot of the Lasseter-y kind of movies.
A very different vibe compared to the Lotso Hug and Bear era of Pixar.
All these cars. I mean, you don't need to work anymore. You literally got Disney to build Radiator Springs.
Well, he's a sicko. He loves that work. He could have retired right now, but he wants to run Skydance. But yeah, it's
those loud Hawaiian shirts don't pay for themselves.
But it is interesting to me, Rich Moore, his pathway, because he worked at Disney, and then actually around when Lasseter left, I think he thought he'd end up getting, he might get Lasseter's job, and when he did, these are all guesses, but I got the vibe that. Since he didn't move up to, he's a guy who could have had Lasseter's job and being in charge of like all Disney and feature animation, but wasn't. And he's like a 2-time Oscar winner.
Did Lasseter, was he in charge of like parks as well? They gave him the keys to like everything.
He definitely had parks power. Okay. Yeah. And then, so Moore then moved over to Sony where he'd, what is the last 2 years? Who even remembers that? But
we'll get to that with our next news item.
But technically he was at Sony for 2 years with no credit on a released film except for like a consulting producer on, I think, Mitchell and the Machines. But so it seems like he's leaving Sony without having released a film. Now is going to Skydance, and I guess we'll see what he does there.
Well, we've learned from friends in the industry that you can just spend years developing things that just never get made. You were working that entire time, but they just never sees the light of day.
Hey, the money in your bank is real, but as far as it looks like on IMDb, you just didn't make something for 5 years. There was just a giant layoff at Netflix this last week of like, I'm seeing multiple animation people I follow on my feed going like, yeah, I was at Netflix, nobody's ever gonna see that show. And then somebody else replies like, oh, you got it too? I was on another show that'll never exist because it got shut down by Netflix.
I mean, I know why, because they're just demons, but they just raised the price.
Yep.
I feel like they're more popular than ever, Netflix.
Well, in the Cartoon Wars department, actually yesterday, there was an article that was being shared around in a negative way by animation people on Twitter about, it was an interview with the head of animation at Netflix. And he's saying like, we're fighting in the cartoon wars, how Netflix plans to win the cartoon wars. Guess what, Bob? Their plan is it should be cheaper to make a cartoon.
I saw, so that Cuphead show is theirs, right?
Yes. They have lots of good cartoons.
Yeah.
Lots of good cartoons.
But relating to that, I saw that they were selling the lie that, two seasons is actually not one because... Yep. I mean, we all know what they do. They make one order and then they split it to call them different seasons, but they're just they're basically paying for one season's worth of labor but calling it two. And so like shortly after Cuphead goes live, they tweet, it got renewed for a second season. It's coming back in June. You can't fool me into thinking you produced an entire season's worth of episodes in like 3 months.
Yeah, no. You just made 26 and released 13 of them and now it's the other 13.
Yeah.
Like that's... No, our pal and... multiple time guest Lindsay Kaitai, she talked about that too, about how shitty deals in animation right now, which the guild is going against, but the shitty deal in animation right now is like on her show that she had written for Infinity Train was that they technically only had a one season order that locked all of their, like a deal in Hollywood is if you get renewed for a new season, everybody gets a bump up in pay. Everybody gets like insta raise and then probably even an additional raise on top of that. But if you order 65 episodes all at once as an animated series, but still produce it year to year and you can green light 13 more episodes, but it still counts as that one season. So you're not actually getting a season raise.
Yeah.
You're just locked in for like 7 years in some cases.
And sometimes you're not allowed to work anywhere else. And that's why Bill Oakley started his food reviewing gig.
Yeah, that's right.
Because he was locked in his enchantment. But, Netflix is like, let's distribute 40 episodes over 5 years.
Yep. Which,
Four years.
Well, I guess that leads to the other bit of news that involves the ex-Simpsons producer who isn't working for John Lasseter, fortunately.
Yes. Speaking of Bill Oakley, Season 3 of Close Enough debuts April 7th, and Bill Oakley is executive producer on that. And again, another like early pandemic thing that happened that I forgot about, because all the episodes were dumped on HBO Max in July of 2020.
Yep. Yeah, it's doesn't it feel like just yesterday we were doing the regular show podcast of What a Cartoon, saying like, boy, what's happening with Close Enough?
And it was supposed to air on TBS in like 2017.
Yes. Yeah.
So a huge delay there.
But I, as I said before, I really like on this talk to the audience, I really enjoyed the first set episodes of Close Enough. And I think the new season where they're actually intentionally writing 11 minute episodes instead of like editing down 22 into 11 with Bill Oakley in charge, I think could be even better. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to see what Oakley, I mean, J.G. Quintel and all of the regular show alumni who work on that. It's a good show. So I'm looking forward to more of that soon.
I like how it looks. I need to get around to finally watching it. Also in animation news, the Animation Guild did a rally for a better deal in LA on March 20th. And based on the Cartoon Brew article, it sounds like this has not really happened since the early 80s.
Yes. Yeah. There's definitely I've been seeing from animation people follow people who like their jobs are just storyboarder. You will see on Twitter a lot of horror stories. It's just like awful. Like when we've done interviews with people who worked on The Simpsons, you know, 30 years ago, and we see their storyboard credit, like, wow, you directed and storyboarded this episode. Not to get too into nuts and bolts of it, but storyboarding then is not what storyboarding is now. Like you are expected to draw so much more and so many more details in a storyboard because, as in most of America's corporate culture, specialized jobs go away and all jobs go to one person.
I was gonna say this is like every field now. Like when I was a writer, when I started professionally writing like on site a decade ago, I did everything. But a decade before that, you wrote an article, someone edited it, someone put it on the website, someone created art for it, someone promoted it. Instead, 10 years later, that was just you doing everything.
Yeah. And that stuff, just as in the animation industry, does not happen, you know, naturally. It happens because managers above them said, what could we cut? And by cutting that, technically profits go up because we have fewer people.
Yeah.
Well, /that/that/that. Yeah, and that's basically how it is in animation. And just seeing too, like I've seen a lot of, I believe the hashtag is New Deal for Animation. Just look into it. Like you'll read a lot of horror stories about some of the best cartoons you enjoy. You'll be like, oh, wow, they made that under that condition. Like here's another like startling fact from the storyboarder side of things I did not know, which is, when you storyboard something, especially now, you are writing it. You're a writer.
Mm-hmm,
but multiple people tweeted of like, yeah, I boarded for years on show X. And then when I tried to apply for jobs as a writer in a different show, they're like, well, you didn't write. Like, you were a drawer. You didn't. That's not writing. So
it sounds very frustrating.
Yeah, it's very, very sad. I hope they can get that new deal going for them. Best of luck to them. I try to share it in my feed whenever I can.
And in our last bit of news here, it seems that a bunch of Disney folks did a walkout related to the company's homophobic support. And Pixar folks also revealed that Disney cut any trace of queer content from any type of movie that they were making. If they detected it, they would just snip it out.
Yeah, I multiple people reported on this. And the Variety piece on it was really interesting because it was connected to, apparently in the upcoming film Lightyear, there was a woman kissing a woman in it. I don't want to spoil things for people. The article will tell you exactly which women kiss somebody. But the point is, a woman kisses a woman. It had been cut, and apparently it has been added back to the film after all of this.
Is this going to be the bone thrown to people? Like, I recall in Rise of the Skywalker?
Rise of Skywalker. Yeah.
Like, there's, like, one lady hugging a lady at the very end when they're like, yay, we did it! I forget what they did because the movie sucks, but is that sort of, like, the same idea? Like,
from the description, this is a more major character than the periphery that was put into. But, yeah, I mean, even in Turning Red has multiple things in it that make me think this is as gay, especially after Pixar told their story in a group message. I was like, oh, there's stuff in Turning Red that feels like this is their compromised, less gay version of a gay thing they wanted to put in. And same with the in that same Variety article, they talked to the director of Out, which was like an explicitly gay Pixar short that was made that was really cute, and I liked it a lot. And hey, I like any story about bearded gay guys in it, but that guy doesn't work at Pixar anymore, and he said he made it pretty clear of like, well, I can't say all the details. But yeah, I don't work there anymore. It didn't seem like the best place to be a gay creator.
I want to say that I always think about this, and I'm so sad that Disney ended up devouring Pixar, because I think by this point in time they probably would have made a non-family animated movie.
Yeah.
Not like Sausage Party, but like, here's a PG-13 animated movie. Mm. Here's an R-rated animated movie. Like, where is the animated horror movie that someone could make? I feel like we have so much like potential, but and I think it's because they're all like family movies that they clamp down extra hard.
It looks like Lightyear could be their Marvel movie. Isn't that good?
No. doesn't help me at all.
I think it's too bad for Pixar in a lot of ways. See, the articles also said that like Pixar it's one of those classic things you hear about in a corporate culture where it's like Pixar isn't told often directly by Disney, cut this gay thing. It's more like, why, we'll cut this before we even show it to Disney for approval, because they won't approve. Like, let's just save ourselves some time. I draw all this stuff.
I just hate seeing Bob Chapek. He is like just a big, big, tall, like just skin stretched taut over a skeleton.
Yeah, he's there was a whole other article I read about there's a war going on with Chapek and Iger, man. It's the new Disney war. There's going to be some stories.
They're both Bobs, right?
Yes, the Battle of the Bobs, Bob.
I don't know which Bob to side with.
I guess I don't want to pick one.
Bring back Michael Eisner. Hell, bring back Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Yeah, you know what? They're all about the same age, honestly. Yeah. They're all like either late 60s and 70s. But yeah, it's but it all came down to Chapek not messaging particularly well. People are like, hey, Disney's giving all this money to the homophobic Florida legislature people.
Yeah. I mean, I have little to add, but
yep, ugaroo.
Hey, folk culture, it's bad. all of it.
But I'm glad at the very least it has driven there was a Disney walkout from a lot of employees at Disney who are either queer or queer allies, which, I mean, if this hastens people to do more, united labor action, I that's at least a nice result of Disney supporting homophobes who also support Orlando land deals for more theme parks. That's really why homophobes money.
Their opinion internally is like, well, gay people need to understand that being gay is not profitable overseas. And until it is, we're going to cut it out of our movies.
And you know what? That's not Disney's problem. Okay.
No.
Like, yeah, blame.
You talk to China.
Yes, exactly.
See what they have to say about it.
Anywho, yeah.
Hey, I mean, there's tons of homophobia here, but I feel like that's a huge part of it too. Like the international audience that they're very concerned about.
Yeah, I know. But I hate like it's not untrue. Like, yes, some foreign countries like the Chinese government or Russia's government or Saudi Arabia obviously are going to censor gay content, especially kids content with gay stuff in it. But that is not an excuse for also censoring things in America. Like, I don't buy that. The only way it works as an excuse is of saying like, well, and we have to sell this every single place we possibly could because we need to make as much money as possible.
They don't have enough money, I think.
Yeah, certainly not Disney. Yeah. Anyway, depressing time.
Yeah, let's go on to our news, though. Yeah. News about us. Happy news. Let's talk about what's going on the What a Cartoon schedule. We've got a special April episode. As usual, our April episode is our April Fool's episode. We don't cover a cartoon. We cover a live-action show that's like a cartoon, although in this case, it's a little of both because we're covering the recent Netflix show Saturday Morning All-Star Hits, the first episode of school, and joining us for an interview, like an hour-long interview, is one of the executive producers of the show, Scott Gardner. We had a great interview with him about the show, and then we jump into it with our normal blow-by-blow discussion of the show, the episode.
Yeah, we both love Saturday Morning All-Star Hits. You've heard us talk about it many times on this podcast now, and if you haven't watched it yet, I think it's in every territory on Netflix, and if you like the stuff we talk about, you will like it. And yeah, Scott Gardner was so cool. He gave us this is probably where you will learn the most about the making of the show than I think on probably any other podcast or article that exists right now.
We challenge all podcasts and articles to get on our level.
Scott Gardner, he worked with Kyle Mooney and Ben Jones and all these other folks, and tells a lot of fun stories about making of it. And yeah, we have so much time to such a good time talking about Saturday Morning All-Star Hits.
And you have a week to watch it all at this point.
It flies right by.
Go do that, please. Yeah. And other stuff on the schedule. So the second Monday of April for patrons, we will have a Talking Futurama episode, A Leela of Her Own, starring the great Bob Uecker and Hank Aaron. A Blurns Ball focused episode. The last Blurns Ball mention of any Blurns Ball.
And Bob did his work on baseball history. He really did.
It took twice as long, so please be nice if I get something wrong.
Yes.
And so in programming notes, programming news rather, we're moving Talking of the Hill. Previously, it was the final Friday of the month, but we're moving it to the third Monday of the month. So in order, it'll go What a Cartoon, Talking Futurama, Talking of the Hill, and then What a Cartoon Movie. So that's just how it goes if there's four Mondays in a month, and it'll be like that from now on. It just makes sense to have Monday be a content slot, not just some random Friday.
Yeah, and if there, and hey, you know, as before, if there's five Mondays in a month, well, then the What a Cartoon comes on that fifth Monday, and the fourth Monday is a bye week.
You make your own podcast. How about that? Send it to me.
Or just listen to an old one.
Yeah.
Again, you know?
We've got a vast catalog. And yes, that episode will be Traffic Jam, the Chris Rock guest starring King of the Hill episode.
It's about canceling a comedian. It's never been as old as time.
Never been more relevant. And our What a Cartoon Movie for April, finally, we're getting to it. It might be our longest episode ever. Not recorded yet. We'll see. It is Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And in my notes, I did not include a question mark because there is no question mark in the title. Very important fact about that movie.
I learned that many. I was, when I made the poll for it, I was like, wait, what? Even though grammatically it should have that, apparently the trivia story goes that Zemeckis just didn't like how the title looked with a question mark on it. So he got rid of it.
I'm currently reading the book it's based on very loosely, Who Censored Roger Rabbit. I'm about halfway through, so I'll talk a lot about that on the podcast as well. Very interesting.
Awesome. Yeah. I watched a helpful video detailing all the differences, but I'd love to hear. I'm looking forward to your review of it. And I am reading a book called Pulled the Rabbit Out of the Hat, I think it's called, about the making of Roger Rabbit, in addition to all of the other classic making of features. I'm even watching Mickey Mouse's 60th anniversary thing that is kind of a Roger Rabbit sequel.
I'm really looking forward to talking about it because it was a formative part of my childhood. I was taken to it at the age of six, and it made me realize cartoons are important, which is why I'm doing it now.
And sexy.
Oh, yeah.
No, but yeah, I would think we might not be doing this podcast in a world where Who Framed Roger Rabbit didn't exist.
I don't think we would at all. I'd be a all-star football player. probably not.
I'd be a lawyer. Let's say that. A lawyer bird.
I'd be dead. So yes, and finally in our news, so we're going to talk about what a Cartoon Movie poll will be about, and we're going to do a simple yes no once again because I want to do Toy Story 3. There's going to be a yes no vote on that. We've done one, we've done two, some of my favorite podcasts I have produced. It's going to be fun to do this one because, folks, I rewatched this one last year and I think it is the weakest one, but I do want to talk about it. I still think it's enjoyable, but not my horse I would bet on in this race, in the Toy Story race.
You know, the movie theater across the street from my house, I was sobbing at that. Well, I was teared up. I don't want to say like head in my hands, but
I was puking with sadness.
But I was, it really affected me, but I haven't watched it all the way through in probably 7 years. So I'd be interested to see how I feel about it, especially now after having seen Toy Story 4, which is like Toy Story 3 take 2. Like, what if they do the last Toy Story again?
I want to do Toy Story 4 as well. My thoughts on that movie is send all of Bonnie's toys to hell. The cast is way too big, and the toys I like don't get enough lines.
Well, you know, the Bonnie's toys, they existed to be the cheaper people who could appear in, you know, side content. Boy, hey, you know, if Jeff Garland has been replaced on the Goldbergs, is he not going to be in the any future Toy Story?
There'll be an AI doing his voice. But they'll, like, when they do behind the scenes footage, they'll put in his CGI Jeff Garland, that disgusting troll.
And you know what, listeners, an extra free preview, you know, we're Toy Story's May, and we're going to do it again in the summer. Disney Renaissance summer comes after that. June, July, August will all be Disney Renaissance polls once more.
We know you like it.
Yeah, we haven't, had a good time too.
We haven't done like Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast and a few others. Mulan,
Tarzan, even some crappy like Pocahontas. We haven't done that yet.
How could I forget about Pocahontas?
Yeah, and you know, should we count Dinosaur in that too?
Absolutely not. I will not do a podcast about Dinosaur. You can't make me.
Okay.
Yes.
Then only the good stuff. Yeah. But yeah. But anyway, yeah. Toy Story poll, yes or no? I think I know how you'll vote. But the Roger Rabbit one was like, I think 3% of people voted against Roger Rabbit.
It was him. Yeah. That's what the three people said.
Droopy is a major character in all the.
All right.
Droopy's in every Roger Rabbit short. Of the three shorts they made after the movie, he's in all three of them, which is really surprising.
MGM, he was for sale.
Yeah. Turner was like, yeah, have him. I don't care.
Let's talk about what we've been playing and watching that's not necessarily homework for our shows. And yes, of course, right after our last Talk to the Audience episode came out, Elden Ring came out.
Yeah.
I've had very little time to play it. I play like one 3-hour session every week, maybe a little more. I'm like 20 hours in, but having a lot of fun with that. If you think these games are intimidating, I will say that Elden Ring offers the most options for you to push back against the difficulty.
They're
way more than normal. You're not punished at all for dying, really, in terms of how the last games did. There's so many multiplayer options to indulge in, and there's always somewhere new to go if one place is too hard.
Oh my God, is there ever? Like, that's something, you know, if you come into it with Classic Souls mindset of like, well, this is the tube to go down. Like, I'm just skipping ahead to mine. Elden Ring was my big game of the month too. And yeah, I when I started that game and it gives you the like, well, here's the castle key. And I started thinking like, yeah, better keep going forward, fighting my way there. And that's when, you know, my husband, who also was playing it, was reminding me of like, you can go anywhere else and start leveling and also like work on stuff. I was like, oh, okay.
It's surprisingly big. I've been keeping a notebook for quests and stuff. And like,
yeah, me too.
I'll get to a boss in a little dungeon. I'll be like, this is too hard. And I'll write, come back later in my notebook.
Now I'm at, so I'm 50 hours in and I don't want to, you know, hey, Bob, I played 50 whole hours.
Must be nice.
But I did. And one of the fun things is that like now I keep thinking like, okay, primary path, really going to do it today. And then my character will take 3 steps and then I'll look to the left or right and like, wait, that looks cool. And I just leave the primary path and do an entirely different thing.
There's an astounding amount of content in the game.
It's insane.
I expect to be playing it all summer, really.
Yeah, probably into the fall. Yeah.
And speaking of big games, I'm still playing Breath of the Wild. You know what? Even I'm playing Elden Ring and Breath of the Wild side by side. Mm. And my one like X-Men mutant ability is to be able to switch to a different control scheme instantly. Like,
that's
I have no problems with it at all. And you know what? Breath of the Wild, even compared to a game 5 years later that's much more ambitious, it's still a lot of fun. I defeated all 4 of the guardians that you fight in the game, and I just have Ganon's castle left to do and not a lot of side quests left. So I think I'm going to finish it soon, and I'm hoping for a Breath of the Wild 2 announcement at E3 this year. That'd be amazing.
Are you going to approach the DLC of the Breath of the Wild?
I've already done most of it. The bits I have left are like really annoying, where it's like you have a weapon that kills anything in one hit, but you can only take one hit. That's not very fun.
You know, Breath of the Wild compared to Elden Ring, I would miss the Spider-Man ability that Link has, but oppositely, it'd be really nice to have a horse with a double jump in that game, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. So, like, Breath of the Wild is so much easier than Elden Ring, but once you play enough Breath of the Wild, it's like, okay, these are the 10 enemies you'll fight. These are, like, the 20 different set pieces you'll see. In Elden Ring, every couple hours you'll be like, what the hell is that?
Yes.
Happening here? What's going on? Like, I don't know where I am. All like, that's what I hope Breath of the Wild 2 does, like more like what the hell moments. And also a blast from the past, because it's been a very busy month for me, making a lot of podcasts, and sometimes I don't feel like playing Elden Ring at night, a very challenging game that stresses me out. So I've been playing Kirby Triple Deluxe. I just finished it today, the 2014 Kirby game. I miss like 20 years of Kirby games, because I'm just like, whatever, they're short and easy, I don't care anymore. It's such a well-made game, and it's so good, and it's on sale for $20 on the eShop. I've also been rewarding Nintendo for taking away the shops
right.
by giving them so much money to buy all the games before they shut things down. So yeah, I bought Triple Deluxe, I bought Planet Robobot, I bought a ton of other games. But yeah, Kirby Triple Deluxe, if you slept on it, it is like such a well-made game, and I had so much fun with it. Just a nice winding down game that's just difficult enough to still be interesting.
Yeah, I love that game. I can't remember if I beat it or not when it was new, but I really loved it. It used the 3 dimensions. It's almost like it got the memo. It didn't get the memo that like, oh no, we don't actually use 3D effects anymore in 3DS games. And it has so many cool like 3D things in it. Yeah, I like that one a lot. I think it was my favorite of the many Kirby 3DS games. I think it was my favorite.
Yeah. I've been going through a real Kirby renaissance because I'm doing some podcasts in the future about Kirby. And I bought like every Kirby game on the Wii U Virtual Console. I bought the ones for 3DS. I bought the one for Wii. I have the Kirby and the Forgotten World downloaded on my Switch. It unlocks tonight.
Hell yeah. Yep. So, can't wait for that. That demo rules. Yeah. Like, yeah,
the demo's like an hour long if you really get the most out of it.
Yeah, I can't wait to play that starting tonight, I guess, it unlocks. I've been really looking forward to like, oh yeah, boy, Pub's out of town. Kirby time for me.
And as far as watching, it's been a busy month. I have not watched a lot of stuff. I watched Goodfellas for when we recorded Bart the Murderer earlier this month. And good movie. Mm-hmm. Do I need to tell you this? Absolutely not. But yes, it's a great movie. The second time I've seen it, the first time I've seen it in HD, it was great to revisit it.
No, it rules. It's like one of the best. What I said on that podcast is it's like one of the most watchable films I've ever seen. Like you can just turning it on, I'm like, yep, I can just sit here for 3 hours or close to it.
It's a great movie to soak in, and it makes you hungry for Italian food.
man, yeah. You got to cut the garlic real thin. That's
with that razor blade.
Yeah.
Fat Tony does it in prison. and then I watched Last Action Hero for the second time in my life, much like Goodfellas. And you know what? It's like halfway towards being a good movie. It's too devoted to being a sincere action movie to make fun of the genre. Like, there's like one thing I'll say about it, it's full of really cool action scenes aren't jokes. It's just like, here is a sincere action scene in a movie, and it doesn't really go far enough, and it has what We Hate Movies calls a disgusting shit boy as the lead, like a little mop-headed kid, which was basically me in 1994.
I seriously had a friend who looked so much like that kid in junior high. Other people would say, like, you were in that movie, right? And he's like, no, I'm not that kid. Like,
and that kid, his purpose in the movie is to explain all of the jokes to you about action movies, where it's like, if you just showed me the joke, not have the kid say, see, it's a 555 number, those don't exist in real life, I would have got the joke without the little mop-headed kid pointing everything out.
My favorite joke in that movie is when they go to a Blockbuster and they're like, okay, I'm going to go to a Blockbuster in a movie. What is Terminator in this world where Arnold Schwarzenegger is a character?
I wanted more of that. And also the movie has two premises, which is weird. But I like the second premise more. The first premise is, what if a regular kid got transported to an action movie and then they run out of material? And it's like, well, what if an action star came into the real world? Second premise is better, I think.
Yeah, they couldn't choose. But, you know, and then these days, it's like the comedy's better in these types of parodies, but the action sucks. They don't actually give you good action. At the very least, like, was it John McTiernan, the director of that? It was the Die Hard guy?
I think so, yeah.
Like, they could give you good action even if it's like crappy jokes about like Jimmy the Fart has one last pass him gas or whatever at his funeral.
Oh, God, yeah. One thing I laughed at was, the classic My Mighty Heart is Breaking from Bart's, what's the name of the episode? The Boy Who Knew Too Much.
Yes.
Yeah, the funny thing is Maria's in the movie, as is the Humvee. I'll be in the Humvee.
They were extra direct in that joke then. Yeah, magic ticket my ass.
You don't. And the rules of the magic ticket are very odd, but there are some funny things in there. I also watch. I'm a big Joe Pesci kick.
Yeah, what the heck?
I watched.
Does he amuse you, Bob?
He does. I think he's a clown. Oh no, I'm being murdered. I watched My Cousin Vinny. I think I saw parts of it as a kid, but I'm like, oh, it's boring adults talking in a courtroom.
Yeah,
it's very funny. Outside of like some light prison rape humor in the beginning of the movie, he's great in it, and so is Marissa Tomei.
She deserved that Oscar.
Yeah,
she did.
I was mad at that Futurama joke all over again watching her in this movie.
It's really too. I feel like her last 30 years of work have proven it was not a mistake, and she's a good actress.
It feels like a movie written before Law and Order existed, because the joke is like he's been to law school, but he doesn't know how trials actually function. Anybody in 1992 has seen enough Law and Order to realize, like, well, this is the arraignment. You say if they're guilty or not guilty, and this is how calling a witness works. I think we've all internalized that based on television, but poor Vinny hasn't. And that's where the comedy comes from, folks.
Also, the battle of Vinny versus, Herman Munster, in the courtroom. That's fun. You mentioning Law and Order, too. That's why also Cousin Vinny feels like from a different era, because this was on our pals Citations Needed podcast, but they talk about how from Law and Order onward, thanks to Dick Wolf, Like, it used to be every legal show or movie was about, oh, the defense. You're with the defense and defending the defender from the evil police who've had the wrong guy. And ever since Law and Order, it's like, no, you're with the cops. Mm-hmm. And the cops are right, and they always make the right choice and put the bad guys away.
In this case, it's him going up against crooked Southerners.
Yeah, these evil Southerners. They don't know anything about grits. They know all about grits, and they don't know. They're telling the Italians they don't know grits.
That's, I learned how long you cook grits from that movie.
I'm not much of a grits guy. I'm not. I'm failing my Southern roots here. Not like,
you got to soak those grits. And last thing I watched is it's basically my during dinner show. It's the anime Platinum End. It's on Hulu. Guess what, folks? It's bad. Oh. But that's why I like it. It's by the Death Note guys.
Oh.
So
huh.
the original comic is from the Death Note guys, and it plays out like a parody of Death Note. Mm. It's kind of a so bad it's good show. One thing I like about it is about halfway through the premise changes, and I really felt the hand of the editor saying, this isn't working, this is your new premise, that's going to be the rest of your story. And they're just like, yes sir, based on what I know about manga. Just like, the editor can be like, no, that guy's got to live, or no, this is where you're going next with the story. And I really felt that. It's like, no, you're not going to make like a Sentai fighting show about angels. It's going to be a more Death Note cerebral thing, and we're going to find out what's happening in the real world and all this stuff. So,
well, you know, the same creators gave us they gave away all of those secrets in their other comic, Bakugan, so we know what the editors do and how they change things.
It's really bad in a fun way, and it actually ends this week, so it's almost all available on Hulu if you want to check it out. But that's it. Not a lot of time this month. I'm very grateful to be busy, but I'm looking forward to a break coming up very soon.
Well, I already talked about all my games with Bob, but Elden Ring rules. I'm 50 hours in. I don't want to spoil anything for any people, but I've done some things. I've got some runes, but I haven't done everything. Achievement wise, I think I have like 300 points, but that's like, what does even that mean?
I have like one achievement after 20, maybe 30 hours.
It's not very giving with achievements, but yes, as for what I watched this month, I was a bit more mainstream of current stuff. But so yes, I watched Turning Red on Disney Plus. It was really great. I thought it was really awesome. I mean, yes, I also can't believe, I mean, yes, I can believe, but anybody who says like they don't understand where this movie is about, or like, this wasn't made for me, this was made for other people. Like, everybody's been a teenager. Like, everybody has been 13 and grown up and, you know, felt horny for the first time. And also, like, I feel like if you are an animation nerd who is watching this, it's about being a fucking like dork who likes, you know, anime. Like, this is about, and this actually is the first time that really feels like it was Turning Red. I liked it in the same way when I first saw Steven Universe. I love Steven Universe because both of them felt like this was finally a show being made by people who grew up watching the same anime and video games that I had, and it feels informed by that. And then when I read interviews with or watched the documentary on Disney Plus about the making of it with Domi Shi, the director, it just it confirmed everything I thought. I was like, oh, here she is talking about how she grew up loving Rumiko Takahashi stuff like Ranma One Half. There I see on her wall she saved her bag from going to the Mama Ayudo gift shop in the Miyazaki Museum in Tokyo that I also saved. Like, I knew her as a real fan, and so not that she has to like prove to me she's a real fan like to make this thing, but knowing that was the drive behind the movie, like, it made it really interesting to me. I mean, the concept too feels like something straight out of like Takahashi meets Miyazaki as well, kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it. When it was revealed, my one issue was they made red pandas less cute than they are in real life, because I'm a real big red panda fan. My wife and I send each other pictures of red pandas. We have our favorite Instagram accounts. We have our favorite pandas. I like Jazz at the Kobe Zoo. We're going to go see him when we can go to Japan.
Nice.
He's the cutest red panda, but it should be at least as cute as a real red panda, but it's not.
Well,
and that's,
you know,
my problem.
They kind of want to make her awkward and weird and have it be like, you know, it is a metaphor for growing up. But
I also saw that, I don't relate to this, but I saw someone post this on Twitter just like, oh, yeah, this is every person of color's fantasy that their parent will actually apologize.
Yeah, look, yeah. I, when I... The, I don't want to spoil everything, but when things move in a certain direction.
It has a happy ending that makes you cry?
Yes, yeah, it does have that. But I was like, by comparison, okay, I'll compare it to this. And yes, this is another Asian thing I'm comparing it to. But in Crazy Rich Asians, which I felt worshipped money way too much, and it wasn't particularly critical of class or anything like that. But one thing I really liked was that when in that movie they meet the wise old grandma, the wise old grandma actually is like very closed-minded and sucks. Like you keep it, because I was expecting, oh, the wise old grandma, they usually make her a good person and that stuff, even though that's not always the case with people's grandparents. And I felt more conflicted about the next generation, and it is about generational trauma, Bob. That's okay. What everything is. But
overcoming it?
Yes, also that.
Processing? Okay.
But also, hey, it's about 2002 and having fun in Toronto.
I like that angle of it for sure.
Yeah. Also, I saw The Batman. It's good. It's good. I see people calling it the best Batman movie. I'm like, I don't think about that. But it could be. I have seen the story of the Batman so many times, and I know every comic they're taking from, and I can just point it like, all right, that's from that one, that's from that one, that's from that.
I might end up seeing it if my wife wants to see it. I don't know about sitting in a theater for 3 hours, although I did see Drive My Car for 3 hours.
Yeah, you know.
And this is probably more exciting, although I did enjoy that movie. But
Batman dramatically walks upstairs in the start of Batman. The Batman I thought was pretty good. Of course, it's worshipful of cops, but that's every Batman movie. Like, why wouldn't it be? But yeah, it's and Robert Pattinson is a quality Batman. Zoe Kravitz is a good Catwoman. It's and even Colin Farrell as the Penguin is pretty good. And it's a really good Batman movie. I wouldn't say it's better than The Dark Knight or Mask of the Phantasm, but is it the third best Batman movie? Maybe.
Batman Returns. Come on. Give it up.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I mean, I was promised that it was as horny. Like it was, horny superhero movies are back. MCU is sexless, but the Batman is sexy. It is certainly sexier than any Marvel movie, but it can't compare to the sexuality of Batman Returns. You know, it can't.
And they're making more with him? Are they making more with Pattinson?
Yeah, I think he's signed on for more. They're definitely, well, first next year is going to be the Gotham PD television show, streaming series on HBO Max. Hmm. That's the next one. And I would guess by the end of this year is that Bruce Timm Batman thing that Matt Reeves is also producing. But as for other TV shows, been watching, catching up on Atlanta. It's a really good show. I'm glad I'm finally watching it, full of great actors, and it's a really interesting stories. There was an episode about trans people I didn't particularly agree with, but you know.
Is it an older episode?
I mean, yeah, it's from like 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. And then also that show Comedy Bang Bang, the TV show, I really love. It's on Tubi now. Just pull it up, give it a watch. Every episode is great.
It ended up on Tubi?
Yes, as is the Birthday Boys show. Both seasons of that are now on Tubi to watch with ads.
I mean, I don't want ads, but
also there's official, it's also on Plex. If you have the Plex app, it's just like, hey, watch it on Plex. Like Tubi stuff is just on Plex now. If you
I want it to be places that I already like have access to.
Plex isn't just for pirated content anymore, Bob.
It's actually legit.
It's legitimate Plex content.
Wow, yes. Interesting. That's where all the Roku shows are going to end up soon.
And Mystery Science Theater 3000 season 13 is getting started. For part of the Kickstarter, you got to watch the first episode early, and it was good. It was the a new Santo movie. They did a Santo.
I think it was a live stream, right?
It was live stream, yes.
I paid for the Kickstarter. I got access to the Gizmoplex, but I couldn't find the stream after it went live, so I pirated it basically just to watch it. And it was interesting. I think it's better than the Netflix ones in terms of the jokes in the theater. This may make me unpopular with people, but I don't like Felicia Day in this at all. She's got some real theater kid energy that I don't like in my Mystery Science Theater.
Sure, but you know, after Patton Oswalt, she's the most famous person in it. You know, gives her some fame. I barely see her. You know, that's but yeah, I I don't love her in it, but it was funny hearing the behind the scenes on it of how, like, it is an HD film they did. And it was, you know, that Santo film, it's Santo versus Dracula. And in that one, they did a kids version for Mexico that most people had seen. And then there was a European sexy version that has, like, naked women in it. And that was re-released in, like, a 1080p remaster. Mystery Science Theater got their hands on that version and then chopped out all of the boobs. So
yeah, based on what I've seen of the riff, I watched like 10 minutes of it. It's like they're always improving after the Netflix stuff started. So the first Netflix season, for me, it's hard to watch because it just feels like they're reading these riffs out of context breathlessly.
Yeah.
It feels like just, guys, slow down. It doesn't feel like they're reacting to the movie. In the second set of episodes, it did feel like it. Now it feels as natural as it did in the cable TV days. I don't know how much they've changed the process. It does feel like they're actually sitting in front of a green screen and looking at like their notes.
It does feel more relaxed and natural. Yes, I agree with that first episode. And two more quick things I want to mention. The YouTube channel Cartoonist Kayfabe, I think I mentioned them before, but they have some really cool stuff this last month. They did a really neat one about Matt Groening's advertorial he did for Apple computers in 1989, right before the series debuted. And they their thing is, they're comic historians, but they're also comic artists, and they know a lot about the inner workings, like business-wise, about being an independent comic artist. So it's not just hearing them go like, this was when this was published, here we are looking at this rare comic, and you can pause at any time, and they go like, oh, that's just Milhouse. He just drew Milhouse in this scene or whatever.
Oh, yeah, there's like literally Milhouse exists in some of the art.
But also they say like, oh, I bet he got paid this much for it, and hey, there's this lost poster, costs this much if you want to get it on eBay. It's I learned a whole lot, and they promise to be doing more Life in Hell in the future, so I'm looking forward to that. And lastly, one more thing I enjoyed this month was the JLA Avengers re-release, benefiting the Heroes Initiative charity. If you're a comic super fan, you probably know about George Perez, who is maybe the best superhero comic artist of the last 40 years. And sadly, right now, he has pancreatic cancer, not looking great. But his comic, one of his masterpieces is the JLA Avengers comic, where it is the ultimate crossover, the best crossover of Marvel and DC stuff there ever was. Every character meets every character in it. But it was out of print for 15 years because Marvel and DC hate each other and didn't want to publish more of it together. And only because everybody loves George Perez so much and wants to support his charity of choice, they allowed 7,000 new copies to be published. And it might be the last time it's ever published until Marvel buys DC, I would guess, or Disney buys DC. Until then.
All going to charity? The money?
So,
proceeds?
Yes, the proceeds of buying the comic, that all goes to the charity. I got a copy of it that I bought at a much higher than retail price, but all of that also went to charity. I wasn't just paying off a scalper on eBay. So, and yeah, if I was going to buy it from a local shop, but they were like, oh, we're going to do an auction later to sell off the two copies we got, and that's all going to the Heroes Initiative charity as well. And the Hero Initiative charity, by the way, is one of those charities that, like, it's amazing that it exists and it does great work. It also simply should not exist, because Heroes Initiative is one of Perez's favorite charities. It exists to help the elderly and poor creators of comics who end up penniless because their companies like Marvel and DC ripped them the fuck off.
It's like an old actor's home in
the 70s.
Pretty
much is. Like, and it needs to exist because these people die in poverty, or just like they have no health care. They were freelance. And I'm glad it's getting money, but every time I've given a Hero Initiative, I also just feel so much rage of just like, Marvel and DC alone should be giving this like $200 million a year, like, to pay these people. But of course they're not going to, and it angers me. It was really great to appreciate George Perez's work one more time in the JLA Avengers collection. And Yeah, you know, it's bittersweet too that it got back in print. But he's, if you've never, I mean, if you are a super fan who never had the old collections or the original copies of them, and you wanted to check, to don't just buy it off some scalper who's selling it for $500 on eBay and it all goes to him. Please look into people selling it where the profit goes to actual charities.
Now, are you going to like encase it in Lucite? What are your plans for this
yeah,
book?
Yeah, I mean, I actually do plan to like frame it and put it in a picture box frame, because I already have my original copies of the first four of all four issues of it. So one of them, I believe I even got signed by him. But so I don't really need to like flip through it, though. There is like a new intro written by the writer, Kurt Busiek. So I might give that a read. Hmm. But yeah, no, I'm just going to keep it pristine just to remember. And my husband's an even bigger fan of George Perez than me. He has an original piece of art by him. Hmm. And like he drew my husband's favorite superhero is X-Men's The Beast. His name's Henry too, The Beast.
Oh,
He's right there.
Yes. I'm looking at the cell on Henry's wall.
And the best artist to ever draw The Beast, Hank McCoy, is George Perez, and he got a piece of art by him on that. So, but anyway, that's what I did this last month.
Okie doke. Let's move on to comments and questions. We're going to start with Talking Simpsons. The first episode is Treehouse of Horror 12, and Christmas Ape says, while I remember the first two segments of this Treehouse just fine, for whatever reason, I forgot that the Harry Potter parody was in this one. Maybe it was because I missed that part the first time I saw it. It's also possible that I thought there was no way they did an extended Harry Potter riff before the movie came out. Usually their Treehouse parodies are a few years behind. I mean, the last time I saw a new Treehouse of Horror on TV, they were doing a Coraline parody close to 10 years after that movie came out. Kudos to them for being ahead of the curve that time, although it probably led to the segment having so many non-specific jokes. And yeah, I think we came down to the argument that we're not against them doing it, but they didn't have the confidence that people would get it. So it's just a bunch of like generic wizard humor.
Yeah, just like general magic humor. They didn't trust, and because they didn't have the movies to go by, they couldn't get specific in the way that of trusting that readers would know it. But yeah, it's easy to forget that one was actually right before the release of the first Harry Potter movie, which Harry Potter was in the conversation lately too, because that YouTuber Sean did a really great breakdown of the Harry Potter books.
And J.K. Rowling is still out there saying stuff.
Oh, she's not going to stop, Bob. And you can't silence her, you know?
That's what I want, though.
No one's going to tell her she's wrong. But yeah, the Sean video is great. He barely even touches on her, you know, obvious transphobia. But his main point is like, oh, after actually finally reading these books, they are way meaner than I remember. And how, like, cruel and all this. He's like, oh, yeah, they cut this shit out of the movies because it was like mean as hell and defending slavery.
Well, you know, One Piece is soon going to pass Harry Potter in terms of books sold.
Oh,
so
thank God.
Screw her.
Yeah. Luffy, you know, that he hasn't been canceled yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. Also on that episode, Sarah says, I have a shockingly relevant story about garbage disposals since they came up. Or garbadors, as they're called in Canada, right?
Garbarators. A garbador is a man who fights a garbage disposal.
I've only ever lived in one place with a sink disposal, and I was always terrified of dropping something down and destroying it. One day, it completely stopped, and I had to dismantle it to figure out what was going on. It was disgusting and awkward, and what I finally pried out of the blades was my partner's enamel pin of Marge as a witch from season 9. It was so absurd, and I will forever associate Treehouse episodes with it. So yeah, it's an enamel pin will screw up your garbage disposal.
God, I'm just thinking of the noises it would make.
Ugh,
I'm looking forward to this new world of appliances when I move. I'm living in a 100-year-old building now, and I'm just imagining, like, imagine what if there was more than one outlet in every room, and those outlets had three holes.
Three hole prongs?
Could you imagine that?
You know, my garbage disposal, the last thing they got stuck in it was a tiny spoon. And
you got to stop freebasing. I keep saying it.
But I didn't have to clean it up myself. I could just call Stern Lecture Landlord, who gave me of like, hey, you know what? You might have to pay your $500. You'll lose your deposit.
You had to call Spoon Man.
Yeah, the old Spoon Man.
No, Counting Crows taught us all about him. Moving on to Stark Raving Dead, a fun episode to do that was obligatory. And I think we had a fun discussion. Well, not fun. Let me split that again. We had a productive discussion.
Yeah, and Nathan Rabin was a great guest for it. It was almost worth it. If you write the word Michael Jackson on Twitter... you're going to have to mute a lot of accounts, and it's no fun.
It is. It's not fun. So, Batman Boy 11 says, I don't think I've watched this episode since the podcast originally covered it back in 2016, and whoa, boy, was it much more uncomfortable this time, and even more so after you guys really dug into how creepily it mirrors Jackson in real-life grooming. While this by no means is a piece of lost media, and I can't really disagree with the wishes of those involved like Al Jean, I do still wish stuff like this would come with some kind of introductory stuff about its issues rather than just being swept away and ignored, but still available without context if you look for it. And, I mean, yeah, that was my opinion going into the episode again, where it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, Act 3 is like the Michael Jackson grooming PR machine.
Yeah, and it's gross. It's really gross. Like, every time Bart says, like, oh, I love you, Michael Jackson, it's just like, yuck. Like, but, that you know, the best... I have seen other people say, like, oh, the swept away and ignored thing is... it shouldn't do that. And the only... amenable argument I've read about that is that, and I still agree of like, nah, it shouldn't be on Disney Plus, kids shouldn't see this, but is that one bad part about it being swept away and ignored as chosen by the creators of the episode is that it allows people to pretend they didn't help Michael Jackson or weren't part of the mm-hmm. Michael Jackson machine then. I had this same feeling. I didn't say it on the episode, but a frustrating thing with Leaving Neverland was that right after it, they put out a, you know, a further conversation about it with the two men and the director as well. And it was hosted by Oprah. And Oprah, you know, I believe, is a survivor of child abuse as well. And she had, the audience was entirely people who have also come out with their own stories about being groomed and getting over that everything. And I was like, wow, that's very important. But not once in that did Oprah talk about how she was a platform for Michael Jackson to defend himself more than once about these accusations.
Yeah, like, she had like the Michael Jackson I'm Normal hour.
Exactly.
Like a lot of people had.
And I feel like if you were part of that machine, you should. And if you then make a thing later about like, boy, I didn't know this about Michael Jackson, it's like, I feel like you should at least admit that like you profited off of that machine then, and you at least talk to it, you know. That I don't like that Disney gets to pretend like, well, I mean, yeah, we did work with him on Captain EO and spend millions of dollars on it. I mean, you know, but not now.
It's just like, interesting on that commentary from 20 years ago where it was just said matter-of-factly. It's like, oh, yeah, and he wanted to stay up all night with Bart. He wanted to write that in anyways. Yeah. Like, moving on. Like, well, wait. There was, like, the trial in 93. You didn't think twice about that after it happened?
Yeah, even after that happened. Like, they recorded that before his 03 trial. Yeah. But still, it's like, guys, come on. Come on, man. But in happier news on that episode, Nina Matsumoto had to say, I've come here in defense of stationary sets as a great gift for a thoughtful, creative young girl like Lisa. A nice blank journal, pens and paper, pens and pencils, cute erasers. I went nuts for those as a Lisa type girl myself. I had plenty of elementary school friends who felt the same. And I still love stationery to this day. Not every kid covets bikes.
Well, I know what someone's getting for their anniversary.
she's telling you, a journal and pens and paper set.
Lots of stickers.
No, you know what? We were wrong to be so dismissive of Lisa going like, I got for my birthday in that episode. I also, you know, it reminds me again of Turning Red because the main character, Maylin, in it, she really prizes her journal and pen and pencil set that she uses to start growing as an artist as well. And so actually a journal like Lisa's is a pivotal plot point at about the 20-minute mark in the movie.
We're learning about women today.
But I appreciate Nina letting us know that like we had a very male stance on a blank paper, whoop-de-doo, where's Super Mario Brothers?
Maybe if it was a hover bike, it'd be better than stationary. Let's move on to the parent rap, fellow podcaster Drew Mackey says, I wonder how many people my age got to BOC, Blue Oyster Cult, because of Scream. There is a sexy acoustic cover of Don't Fear the Reaper that plays during a scene with Nev Campbell and Skeet Ulrich. In my obsessive Scream fandom, let me discover that it was another reference to Halloween where it's also played. They played my county fair in high school, and me and other nerds knew them from that. By the way, Burning for You is another song of theirs. It may be their greatest jam. And in the notes here, Henry, I have a link to the Don't Fear the Reaper cover by Gus.
Let me give this a listen here. So come on, baby. Right. Take my hand. We'll be able to fly.
Baby, I'm your man. Okay. That's like teenage makeout music, which is definitely why I was in that scene.
No, that's, I mean, that's perfect music for a creepy guy like Skeet to try to have sex with his virginal girlfriend. Yeah, it's, man, that really took me back because I had that soundtrack. I listened to it a million times. That song, though, wasn't my favorite. The Red Right Hand song. Oh, no, Whisper to a Scream by Soho, man. I got to hear that real quick. It's also a cover. The we are, we're just children. That's a good one. My Scream fandom has also been reignited. Much like Drew's lately, about thanks to the release of the new Scream, which I haven't watched yet, even though it's, I think, on HBO Max or something.
I thought you did see Five Cream.
I saw
Scream.
Scream, but I haven't yet seen Scream.
Five Cream.
Yeah, soon I will. But that's another of those like waiting for the break kind of thing I'm gonna do. Now this weekend I gotta watch the Oscar. I want to at least watch West Side Story and or drive my car before the Oscars ceremony this weekend. So, listeners, we're recording this before the Oscars. We don't know when.
You need a solid day for that.
Yes. Yeah. My husband was like, wait, how long is Drive My Car? I was like, there it is on HBO Max. It says 3 hours. He's like, oh, no.
It's almost as long as Endgame.
But it doesn't have the Hulk in it, Bob.
or does it? You haven't seen it.
You know what? You're right. Okay. So, Albert Skoglund also said on that episode, with a lot of expert from saying that he had been an intern on both Maury and the People's Court, so he knows a lot about productions like Judge Judy.
And I recently heard that Maury is finally stepping down.
I saw that too, man. You know,
to spend some time with the Chunkster, that's Connie Chung.
Who's going to take over paternity testing for daytime TV?
The state.
I wonder what it was like, you know, 16 or whatever years ago, and Maury decided his show would only be that. Like, I'm sure it had to be his biggest ratings every time he did a paternity test.
It made his job a lot easier, where it's like, I'll announce the results. You'll dance around and do some comedy breakdancing, and then there'll be a small fight. Like, he just turned into Springer.
Yeah. He gave up on any, if he ever thought he was a real journalist, he gave up on that a long time ago. But so Albert Skoglund continues, as far as how they find cases for the show, every small claims court case becomes public record, so they would search through for cases of people with the same last name, like family members suing each other, or anything with a juicy story. The show would pay their travel expenses to New York City, put them up in a hotel, and give them some spending money while they were in town. The shows also pay out the judgments that's decided at the end, and small claims court is $5,000 max in most states, so most people go on the show because they can't afford and are so passionate that they are right. That's entertainment. And yep, that's an easy recipe for daytime television, like endless daytime television. America is full of jerks who all think they're right, and it's just fun to watch them on TV go like, no, I'm right about this car loan payment or whatever.
And they all come very cheap.
It's funny too, right after this, I heard about two old pro wrestlers were just on the Judge Steve Harvey show. It was Kevin Sullivan and J.J. Dillon, who have not been like pro wrestlers since like 1996. And one owed the other $7,000 in a boat loan thing. And so it was Steve Harvey. But I believe in the clips I saw, Steve Harvey wasn't even treating them as like, you used to be on TV as wrestlers. He's just like, you guys are two old guys. Well, I feel like this guy owes owes the other guy $7,000.
Steve Harvey, not aware of the wrestling world.
I would guess, you know, yeah, I can't think of any time Steve Harvey's intersected with it, unfortunately.
There's still time.
There's still time.
So up next, Mr. Lisa Goes to Washington, hot off the presses, these comments.
Yeah.
And Lockerus says, Taft did not get stuck in the bathtub, despite the prevalence of that myth. He did have to get custom tubs made for his size, but the first mention of quote-unquote Taft getting stuck didn't come up until two decades after his presidency, when a White House usher wrote a memoir.
This White House usher telling stories out of school here.
And you know what? Someone else in the comments mentioned that Taft actually lost a lot of weight when he became a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
Now, that was back in the day when you did stuff after being a president. You didn't just go on, like, whatever, the more expensive Patreon masterclass and teach classes about perseverance and other qualities.
Or Taft didn't give speeches to, like, oil companies or whatever about leadership, you know.
Hey, it's unfair to bring that up, I've heard.
Yeah, it's, you know what, everybody does it. But actually Taft didn't do that, and instead I didn't know about his Supreme Court glow up as well. And and Supreme Court's all over the news today, as soon to be Supreme Court Justice Jackson is being given every racist dog whistle question in the world, or also being asked, like, well, what do you think about a trans person,
Yeah, I've been not watching, keeping an eye on that
it's
news.
It's the stupidest shit in the world. If you're not seeing just, like, a racist dog whistle question asked to her, you then get to see just a very, very old Patrick Leahy going, like, I think that's good. What?
Are you my granddaughter?
also, Joe Hodgson says on that episode, I have come to defend that which is the most succulent of loaves, the meatloaf. A properly prepared meatloaf is not just a lump of ground beef, but more like a traditional Italian meatball made into a meal. Ketchup is not a suitable topping for a good meatloaf. A red tomato-based sauce is fine, but also something closer to a barbecue sauce is pretty good. Maybe it's my Irish lineage, but I also like just a brown gravy, some mashed potatoes, and a vegetable, and I'm good to go. It's a good comfort food in the Northeast during winter months, though I probably only have it two or three times a year. And yeah, there was a lot of pro-meatloaf discussion.
Meatloaf, you know, debate.
Yeah.
Now listen, I grew up in an upper lower middle class household, and 80% of my meals were ground chuck based. So if I never see it again in my life, it'll be too soon. It's just like the cheapest, most prevalent meat. You can just throw in anything and just add calories to your meal.
Yeah, I mean, beef it up, no pun intended, with some other junk around the, you know, $2 of chuck you got or three. You know what? I pretty much cut beef out of my life at this point. I have that like two times a year, but when I have like ground turkey or ground pork, honestly, I have like four other recipes I would do with it before I'd make a meatloaf. I mean, for one thing, I would just make some good ass Italian meatballs with it and not dry it out in a loaf pan. Like, I'd rather just have some succulent balls,
spherical,
on the side. But yeah, also our pal Maddie Kopp as well was defending meatloaf in the chat. In the replies. I'm not as negative on meatloaf as Bob, but it's very low rank for me, and it's an easy one to make poorly as well and done badly. But I don't begrudge the, you know, the very likely American moms who have had to make a meatloaf to just be like, I just got to make something I can just leave in an oven for an hour.
I don't blame my mother, but I think she's the reason why I don't eat meat anymore.
We ate enough in our youths. Yeah,
it's true. I'm full of cancer. Moving on, for What a Cartoon comments. Actually, no, we're What a Cartoon comments. We've got South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. And Dan Vincent says, the Windows 98 scene is a specific riff on a very public failure of a beta demonstration of Windows 98. Bill Gates was on stage with one of his assistants, Chris Capocella, at the Spring Comdex 98. They are demonstrating Windows 98's new USB plug-and-play features. And when Capocella plugged a scanner into the computer, it blue screened spectacularly when loading the drivers. So
classic
wind blows.
That's right. Yeah, I've seen many a gif of that. Man, to think of now, like, we just take for granted If something isn't recognized the instant I plug a USB thing into a computer, I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
It's the end of the world. And like Windows is fine. It's fine. I use both OSs and I don't have a preference anymore.
I still can't believe they did a joke in it where a character shoots Bill Gates in the face. Mm. Like you could, that's the difference between 90s mean comedy and now, among many others. Harry Thornton also says about that film, which everybody loved that episode. We had a ton of new signups, so welcome. To all the folks who came for South Park, stick around. We've got lots of great stuff. But Harry Thornton says that Hyde It's a Musical marketing scheme also happened with another R-rated musical, Tim Burton's adaptation of Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. Funnily enough, that was also a co-distribution deal of Paramount in the U.S. and Warner Brothers internationally. Even after the South Park movie, Moulin Rouge, Chicago, etc., they were so skittish about it being a musical, they hid the fact in the advertising. There are stories of people walking out when they realized it had songs in it. And my favorite work of Mark Shaiman is, of all things, the score and songs he did for Mary Poppins Return. It's not talked about much, but it's amazing how he nailed that old-fashioned 60s style of composing, something that I rarely see in films these days. He really did the Sherman Brothers and Irwin Kostel justice. I still haven't given that Mary Poppins Returns a chance. It was that was kind of a win. It certainly wasn't a big hit for Disney that they thought it would be.
I'm looking at it now, and this is surprising. It made like $350 million.
Wow, man. I guess that's small time compared to like Eternals or whatever. Yeah. But
I guess just watch the scene where like 90 plus year old Dick Van Dyke is dancing around.
Yeah, that's probably impressive. But yeah, you know, I saw that Sweeney Todd movie in theaters, and I do think it was, and of course I knew it was an adaptation of a musical, so it had songs in it, but I can see why back then it's like, no, it's a movie that stars Johnny Depp. We don't want the people who go to see a Johnny Depp movie back then to be scared off because of a song. Like, they don't want to see Johnny Depp singing. They want to see him as like, oh, Johnny Depp plays like a guy who kills people when he's a barber. Cool dude. Not Johnny Depp singing about how, you know, Fleet Street is my city or whatever.
I do want to see that one eventually. I'm more willing to go back to newer Depp. By newer, I mean anything after Sleepy Hollow.
You know, I'd rather watch a filmed version of the stage play or see a staged version of it, because, you know, just like, it's not as bad as, I would definitely say to people, never watch the Disney version, a live action adaptation of Into the Woods. You have to see the real Sondheim version of it because they hack it to pieces. I don't think Sweeney Todd butchers it as much, but you owe it to the soul of Stephen Sondheim to please see the staged production of these before you see the movie versions. Mm-hmm.
And you will get wet.
Yeah.
Moving on, we did Berserk. There's not a lot of comments on that, but I really enjoyed doing it. Check that episode out if you haven't. If you don't know what Berserk is, I think we explained it enough that you'll want to get into Berserk. You'll become a Berserk guy. You'll think your guts too.
Berserk is great, especially, hey, if you're enjoying Elden Ring right now, read Berserk. You're like, oh, that's what this is. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad we did all that Berserk stuff right before Elden Ring.
Yes, Berserk is a great show. Please check out our episode about it. Moving on to Talking Futurama, I Dated a Robot. Michael Bentley says, first, Bad Religion actually had four songs in the Crazy Taxi original soundtrack, although one is just a loop for the character select screen and the other appears over the credits. Second, it is possible to get good at Crazy Taxi and have long runs. However, this mostly relies on using the limit cut to give you a boost. Arcade owners could turn this off, and thus it was very hard in most arcades to play for more than 5 or 10 minutes. But you can do this on Dreamcast. You can get runs of an hour plus if you're good enough.
Man.
And I was not, clearly.
Yeah, no, me neither. And none of my pals were either. I think certainly my little younger brother, he lasted longer in Crazy Taxi runs than I would usually. But no, I never knew anybody who'd get to an hour run. I'm certain there are, you know, great players out there. I could watch a stream of like the longest run in Crazy Taxi and a record making one, but
and yeah. You pointed it out, Henry, like later that year it started the trend that like every open world game with a car had Crazy Taxi in it.
No need
for Crazy Taxi anymore. They'll make two more games, but
that's
still
right. Yeah, it's like, oh, there's still who needs Crazy Taxi when it's just a mission in Grand Theft Auto, for instance. Yes. Also on that podcast, Joe Hodgson says, what sucks about Napster now is what it did and did not change about the music industry. Before Napster, you had record companies and producers controlling everything and making money hand over fist. When I buy music, I want the artist to profit, not David Geffen. And now it seems the current system has only shifted it even more in favor of the controlling parties. The industry is less profitable than it was, but Spotify is making all the money, and it seems only legacy acts are the ones making tons of money these days because they still have enough clout to dictate their own terms. Or in the case of Bob Dylan, they're just cashing out. When it comes to the entertainment industry, it seems artists are always getting the short end and the suits who profit. And it's the suits who profit the most, which, yeah, ironic. It's just, man, it must be an accident that keeps happening. But
younger generations get less money than the last one.
It's sad that, like, Napster didn't. The only thing it upset was the ability of some artists to make money the way they did before. But it's like, yeah, they don't. David Geffen was just pissed that he or the David Geffens of the world were pissed they weren't making money the same way they used to, but they found a new way to make all the money again.
They had to learn a new thing. I feel bad for them.
I feel, you know, it is weird to me, like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen have both recently sold off their entire catalogs. I feel like they just went like, hey, I don't want to leave it to my estate to figure out how to deal with this. I'll just take the big, big payoff right now and just to have like literally close to $1 billion for myself.
Well, Springsteen is now like Barack Obama's best friend. They got to like build a treehouse and stuff. It's like there's no time to make money off of music anymore.
I mean, he's been invited to the Illuminati. That's where he is now. Kidding. But yeah, I mean, that Spotify thing too. It's just, they're the only people who make any money off of music. If you're a new musician or, say, podcaster, you're not making money off of Spotify.
Absolutely not.
That money's not for you. That's for a guy who never writes music or never makes podcasts.
Our podcasts are on Spotify, right?
Yeah. Hey, you might be listening to it on Spotify now.
We don't get any money from them.
No, I mean, yeah, just, hey, we get exposure, the thing that's worth the most.
Yes, it really is. Our last set of comments for the Talking in the Hill episode, I remember Mono, and Robert Flaxman says, so if Hank and Peggy were 17 in 1975, and this episode aired in 1998. Hank and Peggy are canonically 40, aka the age all of us 1982 babies turn this year. Yikes. Also, the bit with the fake movie reminded me of a runner. In the following years, being John Malkovich, where the characters kept alluding to Malkovich's role in that Jewel Thief movie, which was also made up. So yeah, King of the Hill, they arrived at that joke first.
Yes, they did. Yeah, I love that Jewel Thief movie joke in it, though, that you just imagine, like, yeah, well, because being John Malkovich, after the film existed, people could just say, yeah, you know, being John Malkovich. But John Malkovich was one of those character actors that most people who aren't movie nerds would go like, he was like that guy in The Thing or whatever.
I certainly didn't know who he was until the movie came out.
No, I mean, I had to be told like, oh, you've... I had seen Dangerous Liaisons, and I had a friend who really loved his bit in Dangerous Liaisons, which honestly should have been my tip off. That friend was kind of a sociopath. If he's like, yeah, the lead guy in Dangerous Liaisons, that's a cool dude. Like, whoa, wait a minute.
How do you feel about American Psycho?
You know, he liked it as well.
I see.
But not in the, like, cool business guy way, but just he did enjoy it. Yeah, and also, yes, Hank and Peggy, they are our age. That is how it is. They're boring 40-year-olds.
But you know what? 40 is a new 30. It will be as soon as I turn 40 next month.
Yep. Hey, and I'm with you there too, Bob. It's a new 30. It's also the new 30 in that you obviously have to work the same as you did when you were 30.
Oh, absolutely. There are no breaks.
Yep. And you don't own a house just like when you were 30.
It turns out 80 is the new 30 too. Sorry. One more question here.
And Kat Hayberg is our final commenter for the month on Talking of the Hill, saying, Yesterday, when I described myself as tiny, bemoaning the fact that I couldn't reach most shelves and that my feet couldn't touch the floor and chairs because the world is made for the tall, my friend said, you're not that short. It's not like you're Kerry Strug. At that time, it felt like a very deep cut. Yes, I guess. I mean, it's a deep cut of like making a short joke about a friend saying Kerry Strug is, yeah, that's pretty deep cut.
Kerry Strug is 4'8".
That's,
so,
you know, not tall.
No, yeah, no. Yeah. My wife towers over her.
Yeah.
By like 5 inches.
You know, you and I are both the tall ones in our relationships. But,
that's true.
Yeah.
No, whenever, so I mean, because we're living apart right now because of the border stuff, whenever I see my wife, Nina, I'm always surprised by how short she is initially. Like, really? She's really that short. Okay. All right. I think I remember this.
You know, also on that Mr. Lisa Goes to Washington, though, I was again thinking of my the things I'm jealous of the less tall is of, like, people were talking about our Discord of, Well, yeah. Could you imagine opening a laptop on an airplane now, your seat? But if you are a less tall person, if you're under 5 feet, you probably can just open up your laptop in front of you.
Every part of air travel is uncomfortable if you're taller than 5'7".
Yes,
I would say.
Yeah, yep. And hey, I just bought my tickets to go to Vancouver. I'm finally visiting Vancouver soon.
You'll never want to leave, just like me.
It sounds like a nice place.
It's wonderful.
I look forward to seeing that Olympic Village. Seeing where the Olympics
still there, they paid for it. But yeah, thanks for listening to another episode of Talk to the Audience. We've got a really fun April coming up. Again, it's we've been building to this for our entire podcast network. We're going to be covering Who Framed Roger Rabbit at the end of April. You need to be on the $10 level to listen to that. And also, Talking of the Hill is moving to the third Monday of the month from here on out. So a lot of Monday content, a lot of Wednesday content. It's easy to find.
Don't forget to vote in that Toy Story 3 poll as well. And also look forward to that Saturday Morning All-Star Hits About School with Scott Gardner. He was so much fun to chat with. Yeah, so to look forward to watching that. Just watch it all on Netflix if you haven't yet. Please give it a watch. Please. I tried to do
it. You can't do it.
Please.
Okay.
I'm spitting everywhere.
Now you're making people sick.
All right. Sorry.
So, yes, thanks again for listening, folks. We'll see you again next month for another episode of Talk to the Audience. Take care.